So, this talk is about freedom and dogs, and it is part of a larger project dedicated to demonstrating the availability of a tenable conceptualism. I hope everyone has a handout, because I'll work off of it. That's the first thing on the handout. Here I understand conceptualism as the view that our modes of awareness are conceptual all the way down. It's characteristic of both champions and critics of conceptualist views to represent them as obliging us to deny that animals possess any significant capacities of mind. In this talk, I challenge this gesture of denial. I claim that a thoughtful conceptualism can give us the resources to describe the rich range of capacities of mind possessed by animals of different kinds. My specific emphasis is on showing that a conceptualist outlook can equip us to recognize that many non-human animals are neither mere stimulus response mechanisms nor mere systems of exploitable instincts, but rather creatures properly thought of as enjoying forms of freedom. I'm going to focus on the case of dogs, but my remarks have a direct bearing on the sorts of resources available to us for thinking not only about other non-human animals, but also about the kinds of free and rational animals that we human beings are. So here's the structure of the talk. I'm going to start with a few examples. Then there's the middle technical, which all my jokes will sound stale, but I always say this. I say the technical boring part. And then I close with a few examples. So you have something to look forward to, and it lasts almost exactly 45 minutes, which I understand to be your regulation time. So here we go. Many things people say about dogs presuppose that dogs are free in the sense that interests me, namely in that they're neither automata nor enslaved to instinct. One good place to turn for illustrations of this is the work of Vicky Hearn. Hearn, who died at the age of 55 in 2001, was a remarkable person, combining a career as a trainer of dogs and horses with a career as a poet, philosopher, and professor of literature. In her 1986 book, Adam's Task, Calling Animals by Name, she has the specifically philosophical ambition of resisting the tendency of philosophers to impugn the language that animal trainers use to talk about the animals they work with. Hearn notes that animal trainers typically employ language that's not only highly anthropomorphic, but also morally loaded. She sets out to show that trainers often thereby get something right about what our lives with animals are like. Her claim is that the relationships between trainers and, say, dogs, she writes a lot about horses as well, dogs are in fact moral relations, and that we can therefore do more with trainers' language than we can with the language of philosophical and scientific critics who insist on exclusively morally neutral scientific vocabularies. What interests me about the terms that the trainers Hearn discusses use to talk about dogs is that they encode the assumption that dogs aren't simply enslaved to their instincts. Consider a couple of examples of Hearn's having to do with dogs who have been or are being trained to track or follow scents. The first example involves a police officer named Riddle, who's on a training exercise working on tracking problems with his dog, Packer. This is how Hearn describes what happened during the exercise. That's number two on the handout. Another handler, playing the part of a hiding suspect, left the immediate area to hide downwind from the dog-man team, that is, the team composed of Officer Riddle and Packer. Officer Riddle, when told that the suspect was hidden, emerged with Packer, put on the harness and line, and cued Packer to search into the wind. Packer stiffened and started towards a line of cypress trees that had been planted some decades earlier along the edges of the vineyards as a windbreak. Officer Riddle followed him. Packer then slowed, checked some nearby grapevines, working now across the wind and then with the wind to his back. Officer Riddle, figuring that there was nothing in that direction a human could hide in, and that Packer couldn't possibly be working air scent from that direction, because that wasn't where the wind was, stopped Packer authoritatively and redirected him. Packer checked and redirected to work into the wind, began romping about, plainly playing the clown. The handler, Officer Riddle, was advised by the supervising trainer to call the dog to heel without any reprimanding. 50 yards to his left, the suspect emerged from a low drainage ditch that wasn't visible to Officer Riddle. We, that is, the other trainers participating in the exercise, were all silent, contemplating the implications of this breach of trust for Packer's future work. Now consider a second case of Hearns. This case involves a police dog, Rinnie, and its handler, John Judge, who were called upon in the following situation. What happened is that a man named Chuck Smith, who had the job of collecting supermarket receipts and placing them in the night deposit at the bank, called the police to report that he had been kidnapped in his own car and robbed. When Rinnie was brought on the scene and asked to search the car, the dog calmly and without hesitation walked around the car to where the victim was talking with a police officer and bit him in the seat, bottom. John Judge, the handler, was chagrined. He severely reprimanded Rinnie and the dog was disgraced. Yet later it turned out that Rinnie was in fact correct and that Smith had planned the robbery together with an accomplice. As a result, this is a quote, John Judge and Rinnie were restored to honor, unquote. Within Hearn's accounts of these two cases, the relationships between handlers and their dogs are described in morally charged terms. When in the first case, Officer Riddle refuses to follow Packer's lead in the training exercises, he is, in Hearn's words, guilty of a failure of trust. Similarly, when it's shown that Rinnie was right to identify Smith as the person guilty of robbery, Rinnie is, again in Hearn's words, restored to honor. In representing these dogs as trustworthy and not merely reliable, Hearn is presupposing that they're not mere automata or slaves to instinct. She's presupposing that they are in some genuine sense free, and that is the presupposition that interests me. Here I tell a philosophical story about how to understand the relevant sort of canine freedom. My story unfolds within the context of a conceptualist outlook. To get the story started, I need to say something both about why conceptualism is often connected with skepticism about animal minds, and about why this connection is not a necessary one. So now I'm starting the technical, boring part of the talk. Although conceptualisms are contentious, there's widespread agreement that they commit us to denying that non-human animals possess significant qualities of mind, and it's not difficult to account for this agreement. Philosophers frequently operate with views of what concepts are that appear to imply that all non-rational animals lack concepts. Given these views, it seems to follow from a conceptualist position, not only that no non-rational animals possess mental qualities fundamentally similar to those typical of rational human beings, but also that non-rational animals lack the modes of awareness that would speak for ascribing to them any substantial capacities of mind. Yet a good case can be made for rejecting these conclusions. The conceptualist position from which I'm going to start is the one described in the writings of John McDowell. There's a sense in which my selection of McDowell's work here may seem surprising. McDowell gives his first overarching account of his preferred conceptualism in his 1991 monograph, Mind and World. And in the years since its publication, this book has been repeatedly criticized, specifically for depriving us of the resources to credit animals with any except very primitive capacities of mind. I have a list of something like, 25 to 30 books and articles that criticize him in that way. It's possible to find textual support for this criticism in McDowell's book, but it's also reasonable to think that in the passages in question, McDowell fails to do justice to the implications of his own views for how we think about the minds of animals. In his most recent work, McDowell represents his conceptualist claims as part of a descriptive account of what our modes of awareness are like, insisting at the same time that the claims impose no antecedent constraints on how similar to ours animals' modes of awareness may be. Beginning from these portions of McDowell's thought, I'm going to argue that a conceptualist orientation can position us to do justice to observations indicating that various non-human animals have sophisticated qualities of mind. The conceptualist orientation I favor is, however, different in significant respects from McDowell's and these differences will emerge as I proceed. Consider what motivates the conceptualist outlook that McDowell defends and I'm going to inherit from him with some revisions. McDowell situates his conceptualist outlook within the framework of his discussion of what he calls a minimal empiricism. That's the third thing on the handout. What McDowell calls a minimal empiricism is minimal in the sense of being not about the relation between experience and knowledge, as traditional empiricisms are, but rather about the relation between experience and thought about the world, without regard to whether that thought is, in McDowell's terms, knowledgeable or not. To count as what McDowell regards as a minimal empiricism, a position must take experience to mediate the way in which thought bears on and answers to the world. McDowell holds the reasonable but not uncontested view that to jettison a minimal empiricism would be to jettison the very idea of thought being answerable to the world. He presents the conceptualism he favors in the course of developing this view. McDowell's account of the necessary elements of a minimal empiricism starts like this. He gives a description of what it is to have one's mind directed towards the world. This description is one he takes with a slight change from Wilfred Sellers. The relevant thought of Sellers is that to represent something as a state of knowing is to place it in a normatively ordered space of reasons, or to place it in a way that makes room for questions about, among other things, what justifies it. McDowell's point is that this Sellarsian thought is pertinent to non-knowledgeable thought, and that a normative context is necessary for the very idea of being in touch with the world. Here we already have before us the fundamentals of McDowell's conceptualism. McDowell is saying that thought about the world is at home in a normative framework, in the sense that it makes sense to ask what justifies it. Further, he's suggesting that with regard to non-inferential perceptual thought, experience plays this justificatory role. McDowell gives this line of reasoning a conceptualist twist by claiming that it's only by depicting perceptual experience as conceptual that we can do justice to the rational support it gives to beliefs about the world. The things I've been saying thus far about McDowell are relatively well known, and now I want to introduce an observation of my own. When McDowell says that human perceptual experience is conceptual, he's saying two distinct things. This is the fourth thing on the handout. To begin with, he's saying that experience has a universal form. Very generally, the point is that in order to make a rationalizing contribution to our beliefs about the world, experience needs to resemble empirical judgment in being about individuals and kinds of things. And in order to be about such things, it must have a universal form. For instance, if someone is rightly said to perceive a flower, a kind of thing, her perception must encode the thought of a link to other actual or possible representations of flowers, and must in this sense have a universal structure. By the same token, if someone is rightly said to perceive a particular flower, an individual, then her perception must encode the thought of a link to other actual or possible representations of the flower, and must, in a similar sense, have a universal structure. This brings me to the second thing McDowell is saying when he describes our perceptual experience as conceptual. He's also saying that reason provides the pertinent universal structure. For McDowell, reason is the capacity to distance ourselves from our inclinations to believe or do things, and to ask whether we indeed have reason to believe or do what we're inclined to. McDowell's motives for claiming that in the human case reason is the source of the universality distinctive of conceptuality are easily grasped. He wants to do justice to the way experience informs our beliefs about the world. He takes seriously the observation that, except in unusual cases, we only say that a mature human being has a perceptual experience when the experience figures in her epistemic life in such a way that she can judge that the world is as it presents it to be. These are the basic considerations that lead McDowell to complement his claim that characteristically human perceptual experience has a universal structure with the further claim that this structure belongs to the province of reason. If I were offering a more detailed treatment of McDowell's work, I would discuss one important respect in which he's recently revised his view of the conceptuality internal to experience. Whereas in early writings, McDowell represents such conceptuality as propositional, more recently he's insisted that it's non-propositional, or, as he also puts it, that it's not discursively articulated. Elsewhere, I've discussed the reasons for this change and argued that the change is consistent with things McDowell says about the rational significance of experience. Here, I simply want to emphasize that when McDowell describes human perceptual experience as conceptual, he's exclusively concerned with forms of universality that are permeated by reason in his demanding sense. So reason in his demanding sense is the ability to step back from what you're inclined to think, to believe or do, and to ask yourself whether you genuinely have reason to believe or do what you're inclined to. So the point is that McDowell doesn't limit conceptuality to these forms of universality, those permeated by reason, because he thinks concepts only figure in the sorts of articulated propositions that are the prerogatives of rational human beings. On the contrary, he himself now denies that there's a necessary connection between the conceptual and the propositional. Nevertheless, he's unwilling to talk about non-propositional conceptuality in connection with beings that don't deal in reasons. He insists on restricting talk of conceptuality to us rational human beings because he thinks doing so permits him to capture what's distinctive about our mental lives. The vocabulary he thus adopts has consequences for how we talk both about human cognitive development and about the capacities of animals. And these consequences are one of my main topics. But before considering them, I need to say something about a further feature of McDowell's project, namely his philosophically irregular conception of nature. That's 5 on the handout. It's not difficult to understand why the topic of how we conceive nature is an important one for McDowell. It appears to be a consequence of an enormously influential philosophical limitation of the domain of nature, that a conceptualist understanding of experience is untenable. What gives the question of what falls within the domain of nature urgency is the fact that it seems clear that experience is made up by interactions. Think of them as impingements of the world on our senses. These are interactions that count as natural. But the domain of nature is often demarcated in a way that would exclude experience, conceived as irredeemably conceptual, from qualifying as natural. Nature is frequently conceived as restricted to the subject matter of the natural, or sometimes even the physical sciences. McDowell's claim is that this deeply ingrained view of nature interferes with attempts to depict experience as both irredeemably conceptual and natural. In making this claim, he takes it for granted that the intelligibility of rational relations is different in kind from the intelligibility of the individual natural sciences, or that such relations possess their own logic and are in this sense sui generis. This presupposition isn't uncontroversial, but I need to set that topic aside. Right now, I simply want to make the following observation. Given the presupposition that rational relations are sui generis, it appears to follow from a conception of nature that restricts nature to the subject matter of the natural sciences, that experience cannot be both natural and essentially conceptual. This means that if he's going to defend his conceptualist outlook in an attractive naturalistic form, McDowell needs to discredit this conception of nature. And that is, in fact, what McDowell does. He departs from a philosophically traditional conception of nature, that's 6 on the handout. He favors an alternative, relaxed conception of nature on which nature is capacious enough to incorporate not only the subject matter of the natural sciences, but also relations of reason conceived as sui generis. This means that the conception is capacious enough to incorporate his conceptualist understanding of perceptual experience. At this point, I've described McDowell's conceptualism about perceptual experience. Now I need to add that he presents it as an instance of a larger body of thought. Although his typical strategy is to start by presenting an account of perceptual experience as both natural and conceptual, he goes on to defend the view that characteristically human sensory experience and action are also natural and conceptual. I'm not going to talk about these additional cases in detail. I simply want to say the following. If we understand freedom not as the absence of necessitation, but rather as the presence of rational necessitation, and if we understand the realm of concepts as the realm of rational relations, then the realm of concepts turns out to be the realm of freedom. Now we can say that McDowell's larger project is about freedom, or, as he himself puts it at one point, that it's about how freedom fits into the natural world. When McDowell sounds conceptualist themes, he's attempting nothing less than to do justice to ways in which freedom involving rationality pervades human experience and action. He needs his relaxed conception of nature because he wants to do this while preserving the thought that we are natural beings and such freedom involving rationality is our special way of living an animal life. In the parts of his work I've been discussing, McDowell represents our rational capacities as getting realized in natural ways during our upbringing. In discussing these matters, he brings out one of his better-known technical terms. He represents our rational capacities as composing our second nature. It's down as 7 on the handout, but I'm not reading it. McDowell emphasizes the idea of second nature because he wants to signal that he's committed to breaking down barriers that seem to prevent us from representing cognitive growth as a natural process of growth. What I'm going to argue here is that the same sorts of considerations that McDowell adduces in representing human cognitive development as a natural process also enables us to represent non-human animals as possessing a wide range of different mental capacities. Okay? I'm pausing just for a moment to say, in arguing, I'm going to be helping myself to McDowell's relaxed conception of nature. For a lot of audiences, presumably for part of this audience, that's the most controversial step in the line of thought, and it's not something I neglect, but I can't add it as a sort of footnote to a talk. It's a huge project by itself to defend this conception of nature. I'm more than happy to talk about it. It's a big project of mine. But I'm taking it for granted in what I'm saying. Let me turn now to ramifications of McDowell's conceptualist position for how we think about animal minds. The conceptuality that McDowell thinks informs human perceptual, sensory, and practical experience is supposed to involve forms of universality that are permeated by reason, understood in a sense that does not apply to non-rational animals. It follows that McDowell is committed to saying that non-rational animals lack our forms of experience. When he says this, he gives the impression that he believes that animals lack any significant qualities of mind. But not wanting to give this impression, he sets out to correct it. So consider what McDowell says about non-rational animals in the text of Mind and World. He not only represents them as bereft of the agency and forms of experience, typical of human beings, he also claims that their lives are, quote, structured exclusively by immediate biological imperatives. His point is to stress that in denying characteristically human agency and forms of experience to animals, he's not suggesting that animals are mere automata whose lives are adequately describable in merely causal physical terms. He wants to show that he has the resources to construe animals' responsiveness to their surroundings as involving primitive normative reactions and not as merely caused in a mechanical or automatic sense. With an eye to showing this, McDowell argues that these animals encounter features of their surroundings not as conceptualized entities, but rather as particulars that trigger instinctive or learned responses. He uses a pair of terms from Hans-Georg Gadamer to capture the contrast he finds between the lives of rational human beings and non-human animals. Creatures who exhibit the conceptually permeated behavior characteristic of human beings are, in Gadamer's parlance, oriented towards the world. And creatures whose lives are governed by immediate biological imperatives merely inhabit environments. The point that McDowell uses this Gadamerian contrast between world and environment to make is that non-rational animals are not automata, but beings governed wholly by merely biological impulses. These remarks of McDowell's notwithstanding, it is not an implication of the main argument of mind and world that non-rational animals are enslaved to instinct. In a postscript, McDowell himself admits that, this is a quote, "My talk of biological imperatives already represents a harder line than I need, even without the reductive conception of the biological that I disown." I believe that it is now McDowell's decided view that he was wrong to represent all non-rational animals as structured by exclusively biological imperatives. But why this was wrong isn't something he's discussed at any length, and I want to fill in some of the details. Recall that McDowell's conceptualism is situated within what he calls a naturalism of second nature. If we want to appreciate the implications of this outlook for animal-mindedness, it's helpful to consider what it means to say that rationality belongs to our second nature. The point is that our rational capacities are realized naturally as we grow up. To say that an individual is rational is to represent her as having arrived at a specific point in a natural process of development. In representing the process as natural, we in effect reject the idea that there are prior constraints on how similar to each other different stages on the way to rationality can be. Instead, we commit ourselves to the idea of a naturalistic continuum, and we allow that pre-rational stages involve mental capacities that bear significant resemblances to capacities of mind typical for human beings. Further, to the extent that we make room for substantial affinities between pre-rational humans and rational humans' capacities of mind, we at the same time make room for substantial affinities between the typical mental capacities of humans and those of non-human animals of different kinds. So there is no reason, as far as McDowell's argument is concerned, to exclude the possibility of forms of life that aren't rational in his strict sense and yet aren't products of mere control by immediately biological drives. Mind and World's main line of reasoning obliges us to make room for the possibility of discovering that some non-human animals operate with at least primitive forms of universality and are rightly described not only as dealing in individuals and kinds of things, but also as thereby manifesting primitive forms of freedom. And this is, Sabina Lovabund wrote an article defending McDowell against an attack by Alasdair MacIntyre, and the last line of thought I just followed is a point that she also makes in her paper. It's a nice paper. So, we can, in this way, what I've just shown is, you can use McDowell's work to raise an issue that he himself, for the most part, doesn't discuss, namely the issue of similarities between the minds of rational human beings and those of non-human animals. A reasonable method for illuminating these similarities is to consider similarities between rational human beings and pre-rational or pre-linguistic children. It's not uncommon for very young children, children who are not yet fully rational, to behave in ways that cannot adequately be captured in strictly biological terms. With an eye to defending this claim, I'm going to introduce a vocabulary that differs from McDowell's. McDowell insists on limiting talk of concepts to rational individuals. In contrast, I'm going to say that pre-rational children may possess concepts. Although the terms I employ differ from McDowell's, there's a sense in which they are true to the temper of his thought. when he introduces his relaxed conception of nature, he at the same time invites us to construe our rational capacities as the end results of a natural developmental process. This invitation is supposed to extend to our capacities for dealing in universal categories, as well as to those capacities we have insofar as we can distance ourselves from and evaluate our inclinations to believe or do specific things. Bearing this in mind, I'm going to describe the acquisition of capacities for dealing in universal categories as learning, that's 8 on the handout. And I'm going to describe the acquisition of capacities for distancing ourselves from and evaluating our inclinations to believe or do specific things as maturation, that's 9 on the handout. The portions of McDowell's thought I've been discussing are informed by the very reasonable assumption that learning and maturation are inseparably intertwined. McDowell speaks of concepts exclusively in reference to rational individuals, because his primary concern is the learning of individuals who have reached an advanced stage of a natural process of maturation. In contrast, I'm concerned with mental capacities that are the more primitive forerunners of those McDowell considers. I propose to speak of concepts in connection with pre-rational children, because I want to underline the existence of cognitive achievements that exhibit primitive capacities for operating with universal categories, and therefore count as learning, even though they don't yet demonstrate rational maturity. One philosopher who draws attention to such cognitive achievements is Stanley Cavell. Cavell maintains that in the acquisition of a first language, there is not the clear difference between learning and maturation that we sometimes suppose there is. And he also claims that coming into language involves many steps suffused with elements of both. Cavell's most elaborate illustration of such steps is presented in a central and well-known passage of his book, The Claim of Reason. It involves an anecdote about his daughter's linguistic abilities at 15 months, an anecdote about how one day after he said kitty, she produced the word and pointed to the kitty. She repeated her performance a few times after that, saying kitty and pointing to a kitten. And then a few weeks later, she smiled at a fur piece, stroked it, and said kitty. In his commentary on these episodes, Cavell says that the case of the fur piece made him unsure how to transcribe his daughter's performances, adding that it was in any case clear that his daughter was making connections among kittens and kitten-like things. One thing that may well strike us about this example of Cavell's is how commonplace it is. I recall various analogous episodes in my own daughter's development, and I imagine the same is true of other parents and anyone who spends a lot of time around young children. There's one episode of the kind that I still remember well, in part because it was mildly traumatic. And if you've heard me give this talk before, I say, look, the story I'm going to tell is embarrassing. I chose it because it's authentic. I'm an obsessive diarist, and I write things down, and I wanted to find something that actually happened. And among other things, I got my daughter's permission to use it, and maybe she'll be happy to know this is the last time. By the time my daughter was a year and a half old, she would let us know that she needed her diapers changed by saying, "I dirty." During a trip to California at the time, she wound up with a nasty infection on her behind. On the day on which it was most inflamed, she cried for hours, regularly screaming, "I dirty." In her case, unlike that of Cavell's daughter, there wasn't much room for uncertainty about an appropriate transcription. It was evident that my daughter was expressing pain and a desire that her parents relieve it for her, as we had on other occasions. It was also evident that she was connecting different situations of discomfort in her nether regions. When Cavell characterizes his young daughter's accomplishment, he cautions that it would be premature to say that she knows what a kitten is. And he rattles off a number of facts about kittens that a mature speaker can be expected to know, but that his daughter does not. It would likewise be premature to say that my young daughter knows what, say, dirtiness is. Yet both children have taken meaningful steps toward language. They've acquired repertoires of doings appropriate when, to which their verbal performances belong. Granted that they're still far from word mastery, it remains the case that these repertoires are more than merely causally significant stages on the way to language. And these stages are aptly described as involving the ability to operate with primitive universals. This ability is a conceptual one in my flexible sense. Cavell's daughter is operating with a concept of kitten-like things, and my daughter is operating with a concept of discomfort in one's nether regions. To say these things is not to deny that a substantial gulf still separates these young children from mature speakers. The point is simply that they have progressed rationally enough to operate with forms of universality that are forerunners of the forms we find in mature rational thought. And that's what I have in mind in talking about a flexible notion of a concept. My ambition in identifying this notion can be extended beyond the case of fully rational, beings was to demonstrate that there's no conflict between conceptualism and the conviction that some non-rational animals possess quite sophisticated qualities of mind. Once we equip ourselves with this notion of a concept, we're in a position to reject the suggestion that conceptualists are compelled to represent non-rational animals as lacking any but very primitive mental capacities. A perfectly consistent conceptualist could accommodate the idea that there are significant analogies between, on the one hand, characteristically human modes of awareness and mental qualities, and on the other, those modes of awareness and mental qualities that are characteristic of different non-rational animals. Given that the realm of concepts is the realm of freedom, this means that a perfectly consistent conceptualist could accommodate the idea that there are significant analogies between, on the one hand, free modes of conduct typical of human beings, and on the other, modes of conduct typical of different non-rational animals. So this brings me to the last part of the talk in which I'm going to discuss these analogies in reference to dogs in particular with a few examples. Consider what it makes it seem reasonable to speak of concepts in reference to dogs. We could start by noticing how we restrict ourselves if we rule out this way of speaking. There is, to be sure, still room to represent dogs as learning, if by learning we mean the shaping and growth of natural responses via various feedback loops. But now it appears that all of dogs' natural and learned responses need to be understood as directed towards particulars. There can be no question of discovering canine behavior that is characterized by the recognition of kinds of things or of individuals. Yet it's not clear that we can do justice to the lives of dogs without referring to such forms of recognition. That, very generally, is what suggests the need to attribute conceptual capacities to dogs. Let me start with an example of the sort of case that speaks for claiming that dogs deal in kinds of things. Thomas Mann wrote a memoir of his life with his short-haired setter, Bashan. And in it, he gives an account of a day on which Bashan, for the first time, saw a man shoot a duck. Mann tells us how, after the report of the gun, the body, which had been struck, became a mere inanimate object and fell swift as a stone. Then he turns to describing Bashan's response to the event. And this is what he writes. It's 10 on the handout. There are a number of coined phrases and ready-made figures of speech which I might use for describing Bashan's behavior. Current terms, terms which in most cases would be both valid and appropriate. I might say, for example, that he was thunderstruck, but this term doesn't please me and I do not wish to use it. Big words, the big well-worn words, are not very suitable for expressing the extraordinary. One may best achieve this by intensifying the small words and forcing them to ascend to the very acme of their meaning. So I will say no more than that Bashan started at the report of the gun and the accompanying phenomena, and that this starting was the same as that which is peculiar to him when confronted with something striking, And that all this was well known to me, though it was now elevated to the nth degree. It was a start which flung his whole body backwards, wobbling to right and left, a start which jerked his head in rash recoil against his chest, and which, in recovering himself, almost tore his head from his shoulders, a start which seemed to cry from every fiber of his being, "What? What? What was that? Hold, in this name of 100,000 devils, how was that?" If you read the memoir, and that's just philosophically irrelevant, but Mott isn't really into hunting, and he gets very annoyed with his dog, who becomes sort of a fan of hunters, and sort of admires them and wants to hang out with them. Drawing on his familiarity with Bashan's characteristic ways of behaving, Mott describes his dog as utterly surprised by duck hunting. He describes Bashan as overwhelmed by his encounter with what for him is a new kind of thing. The context for the description is Mon's account, elsewhere in his memoir, of Bashan behaving differently, more familiarly, with things such as roads, trees, people, houses, cats, and trains. What Mon in this way gives us is an image of Bashan as living a life in which there are different kinds of things. Consider now an example of the sort of observation that speaks for saying that dogs deal in individuals. Here we might turn to an example of Simon Glendinning's, about how he used to run around outside with his mother's dog, Sophie. Glendinning writes, this is 11, the last thing on the handout, "There is what I definitely want to call a game I used to play with my mother's dog, Sophie, in which we would run around a small pond. My aim was to catch her, hers to avoid being caught. Sometimes we would find ourselves facing each other, almost motionless, on either side of the pond, each of us watching the other for movements indicating a direction of pursuit or flight. I would try faking a movement, starting to the left but running to the right. Sophie would sometimes be foxed, but would always correct a run when she saw me coming the other way. Sophie had a lot of collie in her, and I never caught her. But one day while we were playing this game, I slipped, as I tried to change direction too quickly on damp grass. Almost immediately, Sophie ran straight up to me. I was unhurt, but she licked my face anyway." When Glendinning comments on this example, his aim is to establish that it's a case of what he calls mutual intelligibility between him and Sophie. "The dog could see my distress," he writes, "and I could see her sympathy." The point I want to make is much simpler than Glendinning's. In playing exuberantly with him and responding to him with sympathy, Sophie was interacting with him as an individual. Within accounts people give of their lives with dogs, it's possible to find anecdote after anecdote, like this one of Glendinning's, in which dogs relate to human beings as individuals. The point is not, however, that human beings are the only individuals in dogs' lives. The lives of dogs are lives in which there may be a rich variety of individuals. In addition to individual human beings, there may be individual places, individual inanimate objects, and individual non-human animals. It's possible without undue difficulty to find anecdote after anecdote about dogs' connections to individuals of these other sorts. What interests me about these anecdotes, as well as anecdotes like Mon's about how dogs operate with kinds of things, is that on the surface they seem to support the attribution to dogs of concepts in the flexible sense I've been discussing. One of the implications of my main line of reasoning is that there are no antecedent philosophical reasons for refusing to take the anecdotes at face value. Admittedly, it's possible to try to fully illuminate dogs' behavior in a manner that's consistent with thinking of dogs as, say, pure stimulus response mechanisms, or alternately, as beings governed by immediate biological impulses. The recent history of animal behavioral studies amply documents such attempts. Yet it's not clear that these projects have a chance of succeeding. It's not clear that putative explanations of dog behavior that renounce any suggestion of conceptual capacities can adequately capture the richness of dogs' lives. I am not suggesting that we should just complacently take our guide from the naturalness with which we think and talk about dogs in ways that take for granted that they're conceptual in my sense. It is, after all, entirely possible that a bit of dog behavior that at first seems conceptual might turn out to be explicable in terms of lower level capacities. It's likewise possible that Hearn and Mann and others who write about dogs have simply imagined that they found impressive qualities of mind in what are in fact very primitive forms of dog behavior, and that these authors have slid into a kind of projective error. A critic might successfully demonstrate that some of the behavior that these authors represent as having a specifically conceptual complexity is in fact simply elicited by environmental stimuli. Such a demonstration would not, however, be damaging to my argument. We should indeed acknowledge that we do sometimes represent as conceptual modes of canine behavior that are actually much simpler. But this gesture of acknowledgement is consistent with claiming that an unbiased review of the thousands of year old body of human observation and testimony about the lives of dogs supports the ascription of concepts to dogs. What we learn from looking over this body of literature is that dogs recognize individuals and kinds of things, and by the same token that they operate with concepts. I have one last remark just to go full circle and go back to Vicky Hearn. It follows from the things I've been saying that there's no reason to insist that people must be guilty of sentimental projection if, like Hearn and the trainers she discusses, they characterize their relationships with dogs in moral terms that presuppose that dogs are, in some sense, free. To claim that dogs traffic in concepts, in my sense, is to characterize them as occupying partial stages of rational development, stages distinguished by partial forms of freedom. In cases in which dogs have been integrated into our household or work routines, there's no reason antecedently to deny that they've become trustworthy as opposed to merely predictable. Think, for example, of the two tracking dogs, Packer and Rinny, that Hearn discusses in the passages that I read at the opening of this talk. There's no reason antecedently to deny that these dogs participate in the sorts of moral relations with their handlers that Hearn describes, or that these dogs are, in an important sense, free. Thank you.